McGill Daily of The Daily.
I'm McGill Daily.
Hi, I'm calling from The McGill Daily. Can I ask you some questions?
This is a little bit problematic.
News. Could I see you for a second?
We're going to cap this.
News, can you dummy?
Did that story come in yet?
Editorial is in 5 minutes.
McGill Daily.
Unfit to print.
You're listening to Unfit to Print, a McGill Daily and CKUT news collaboration. I'm your host, Chantal Schultz. Unfit to Print is a student-produced, bi-weekly show that brings the latest of McGill and Montreal news. Unfit to Print is produced on unceded land on the traditional territory of the Ginyangahaga. The Ginyangahaga are one of the 5 founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy and were referred to as the Keepers of the Eastern Door. This island that we call Montreal is known as Jajage in the language of the Ginyangahaga and has historically served as a meeting place for other Indigenous nations. Today on Unfit, you'll hear an interview with Kai Chang Tom. Coco and Viola from the McGill Daily caught up with Kai Chang over the phone while she was packing for her trip to Montreal for the launch of her new book, Fierce Femmes and Notorious Liars. They spoke about her new book, Resistant Violence, Outfit Choices, and Love. Then you'll hear an interview with George Kurian, the director of the documentary film The Crossing, which screened on November 28th by Cinema Politica at Concordia. The Crossing follows a group of refugees as they cross the Mediterranean Sea from Egypt to Italy in search of asylum in Europe. Kurian discusses the theme of loss in the film, describes the way the movie was shot, and speaks about the obstacles he faced while making The Crossing. But first, headlines. On November 25th, McGill Bookstore employees received an email from their employers explaining that as the store's move from McTavish to Sherbrooke and Park locations has prompted reorganization, casual or part-time employees will only be scheduled during peak hours. The email coincided with the Association of McGill University Support Employees, AMUSE, which is the main union representing bookstore employees, having reached a tentative collective agreement with the administration. Several bookstore employees wrote in a statement that AMUSE's demand that part-time workers who have worked 26 consecutive weeks should be considered full-time employees means that the bookstore has to increase the student wage and supply benefits to workers. These employees feel that this has forced bookstore management to only schedule casuals during peak periods, drastically reducing their overall hours. AMUSE President Claire Michaela has said that she's arranged a meeting between the employees, UNACA, and McGill Human Resources this Friday to discuss employees' concerns. On November 20th, Outremont residents voted to uphold a bylaw banning the construction of new houses of worship on Avenue Bernard by a vote of 1,561 to 1,202. The legislation, introduced last year, would ostensibly ban new religious construction throughout the entire Montreal borough, as a similar ban already applies to residential streets in Outremont. The bylaw remains controversial because while the ban applies to all religious denominations, the referendum results have left Outremont's Hasidic community feeling targeted. Outremont's Hasidic community is the borough's fastest-growing religious group and is expected to be Outremont's largest demographic by 2030. Avenue Bernard remained the last possible area where a synagogue could be built, and since Outremont only has 4 synagogues with a combined capacity of 400, the ban would effectively force Hasidic Jews to travel outside the borough by foot in order to attend synagogue, as Jewish religious law prohibits any form of mechanical travel on the Sabbath, including but not limited to driving a car, taking the bus, or riding the subway. For more in-depth coverage of these stories and for other McGill and Montreal news, pick up a copy of the McGill Daily on stands now or visit our website at mcgilldaily.com/news. You'll now hear an interview with Kai Chang Tom about her new book, Fierce Femmes and Notorious Liars. Coco and Viola from the McGill Daily caught up with Kai Chang over the phone while she was packing for her trip to Montreal for her November 26th Montreal book launch. They spoke about her new book, Resistant Violence, Outfit Choices, and Love. Kai Chang is a kick-ass trans woman of color who lives love and breathes poetry.
The question around autobiography or memoir versus fiction is one that's come up a lot
in different like reviews and interviews, and I think it's really hilarious because I have never once said that the book is my autobiography. Like, I have never said that, but people assume that it is, which is fine, and they're probably right in some way. The way I've been answering the question so far is that that the book is definitely not autobiography, and if you read it, if one reads it, one will see that's definitely true, because, you know, there's, like, all kinds of, there's, like, it's a surrealist novel, and although my life is fairly surreal, it's, like, not that intense, you know? I would say that the novel comes mostly out of Audre Lorde's idea of biomythography, which is this idea that you can start from, like, the factual truth of your own life, but then also mythologize it and use poetic language or magical thinking to capture realities, experiences in reality that are not expressible through cold facts alone. And the quote that keeps on coming back to me when I think about this question, and also while I was writing the novel, was actually from Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire, where the main character, Blanche DuBois, is caught, like, having lied about her whole life and, like, you know, kind of seduced these men and stuff. She's great. And she's caught. And he's like, you know, her lover's like, "You're a liar. You're unclean." And she goes, "I never lied in my heart." And this is what the book, I mean, the book is like, you know, the title is, you know, Vera Stem's Notorious Liars. And it's about how sometimes we have to lie or use fiction in order to express the truth of our lives. And you know, for me, this is kind of like, yeah, I'm able to use this book to express some stuff that's happened in my life without having to directly talk about my life, and yeah. I mean, like I said, I wrote this book for me. Like, I didn't think that anyone was going to see it, so I wrote the book, yeah, I think my vision of the book was like, I wanted to write the kind of novel that I would have liked to have been able to read in my teens. Or also just now, and a novel about trans women, where trans women were like incredibly empowered and also dangerous. Like, danger is a really important theme in the book, because of course trans women live in danger all the time. And I wanted to see a rendering of us having reclaimed that power to be dangerous in some way. And also I wanted to talk about violence. Violence of all kinds, because on the one hand, I think I'm really enamored of violence, and I think a lot of activists on the left and the right, to be honest, are as well. And we see that more and more with the rise of extremism, like the ever-increasing rise of extremism in the United States right now around the alt-right and conservative politics. The left, too, becomes more extreme, right? And it's a sad thing. But also very necessary. And I guess I wanted to write a book that talked about that. Like, what does it mean to be someone who is necessarily, like, who is forced to be violent in order to survive, like most of us are? And then what does that do to one? Like, you know, I think that experiencing violence is very traumatic, and we see a lot of literature about this. I think there's very little literature about how traumatic it is to be violent. And then just to grapple with those choices. Like, I think, you know, the character, the main character in the book, who is the narrator, goes through, like, is like a narcissist and, like, resorts to violence immediately. It's like, basically solve any problem. She's like, "I'll just hit someone in the face." You know? And I wanted to explore what that meant, like, as a caricatured, enhanced portrayal of my own kind of violent tendencies, and you know, maybe if there could be ways out of that, you know, or ways to heal. So this book, I think the project of this book remains, even though, you know, now it is much different from when it began as like a personal project, is to examine violence for trans women primarily, but also for everyone, and how we can understand ways to heal both from the violence that we experience, but also the violence we commit. I knew for sure when I started writing that it was going to start in a certain place with this narrator kind of like becoming what she called, you know, in her mind she calls the greatest escape artist in the world, you know, and about getting unstuck from the story that she was trapped in her home. And then, you know, I think, you know, her conflict and also, you know, mine, and I think that of many women, trans and cis, is like this idea that we're stuck in a story. Like, you know, we've been trained to like want this fairy tale ending, with, you know, all the things that come with it. And honestly, those fairy tale endings feel good. Like, I wanted to give the narrator this opportunity to have like the chance at a perfect fairy tale ending, not a fairy tale ending that's corrupted, which we see in a lot of like feminist literature, you know, like Margaret Atwood or whatever. She was like, I can't give myself a happy ending, but then I don't know if she would have really been happy in her happy ending. So that's what I'm doing. 2 weeks ago I had a book lunch in Toronto. It was really fun. A lot of people came out, which was really, really nice. And it was part of the Naked Day Festival at the Glad Day Bookstore, which people go to because it's this amazing, like, physically accessible, queer bookstore slash cafe slash bar slash event space that has also, like, had, like, a bit of, like, a 40-year history in Toronto. So that was really cool. Yeah, and we had some guest readers. It was nice. I'm in love with my wife, Kamala Macrell. Because she's fucking amazing and changing the world right now. Actually, she's at McGill in an artist residency at the Faculty of Education. And I really hope that this part gets printed or published or whatever, because I just really hope that everyone at McGill is appreciating her and loving her the way she deserves. Yeah, anyway, I'm just really happy to be married to her. So I'm in love with my wife. I'm also in love with... like my very closest, all of my closest folks. I'm in love with, I mean, also particularly I have to say I'm in love with like Emily Clare, because she is like a, you know, also kind of really important and like an amazing artist, and we're working on some projects together. I feel love for like all, I feel love for like the QPOC community in Montreal. Some of you, some of whom I'm speaking to at this moment, I believe, because we've been through a lot. Like, we've been through a lot. Like, so much. Like, in the past 6 to 8 years, we have been through all kinds of hell in Montreal that, like, are particular to being in that space of, like, white, predominantly francophone, but then also really intense anglophone, like, white supremacy. So I'm in love with Montreal. Who else am I in love with? I'm in love with trans women. I'm in love with trans women, and that's a complicated love, which is also what the book is about, because I feel like I love trans women and am terrified by them. And also what was really funny was that one of the readers at my Toronto launch, Gwen Benaway, who is an amazing Indigenous trans woman poet, got up and she was like introducing me, and she was like, I love Kai Cheng. And she terrifies me. And I was like, oh, yeah, really scary. Yeah, so there's that. And I'm in love with, I want to say I'm in love with myself, but I kind of am not, or I don't know. I think I waver on this one. I work on it. I think we all do. Like, we work, we all waver on being in love with me. No, we all waver on being in love with ourselves. Yeah. Can I say something? Okay, I want to say, let's say that you asked me a question about, like, what is it like to be a trans woman of color working in arts and media right now? Let's say you asked me that question, and I said, well, it's been kind of difficult because being a trans woman, but also especially being a woman of color, I think is really, really intense with the media being such a white institution and so traditionally masculine. And I just really, like, I have so much love in my heart, actually, for women of color who are making media and, like, sticking it out, especially in leftist media, because that can be such a bro dude space sometimes. And I really appreciate, like, I'm just really, like, I think it's so dope that I'm being interviewed by two badass East Asian women from The Daily right now, and I value you both so much, and you're both really cool, and I feel like you should become, like, I feel like people should just elevate you to positions of leadership in every media space that you're in. What I really hope for, like, I don't, I'm getting emotional now. Like, if there's anything I want from my artistic life or my working life or whatever, my life in general, I just really want to be there in a good way for other women of color and trans people, because we need each other more than ever. And if art is part of that, or if activism is part of that, or, like, being around for 2 a.m. calls, phone calls, is a part of that, then that is what is nice for me.
You just heard an interview with Kai Chang Tom about her new book, Fierce Femmes and Notorious Liars. You'll now hear George Kurian, the director of the documentary film The Crossing, talk about the film with Ralph Haddad from the McGill Daily. The Crossing follows a group of refugees as they cross the Mediterranean Sea from Egypt to Italy in search of asylum in Europe. Kurian discusses the theme of loss in the film and describes the way the movie was shot by giving refugees GoPros and speaks about the refugees that he worked with. The Crossing was screened on November 28th by Cinema Politica at Concordia.
I just want to ask you if you can describe the premise of the movie for viewers, what they can expect to see.
Well, the film follows a group of Syrian refugees who are living in Cairo, who, when they decide that Cairo is no longer safe for them, they decided to make the very dangerous crossing across the Mediterranean to Europe. And so the film follows them across the journey and into asylum camps in Europe. Most of the time, people imagine that once people come into Europe, you know, it's happily ever after. But a big part of the refugee crisis actually begins once they're in Europe. So the film tries to show both these parts of what it is to be a refugee in the current crisis.
I see that the theme of loss or loss of community really comes through in this movie. Can you speak to the theme of loss or the loss of community with regards to the refugees?
Most of us, when we asked who you are, one of our first responses is, I'm a filmmaker, I'm a student, I'm a journalist, etc. All of us kind of define ourselves by what we do. And one of the quintessential things that happens with being a refugee is that sense of identity is taken away from you. Professional, social, cultural, everything by which you aspired to be a person. And then it's not even about, because being a refugee is different from being a migrant, which is something of your own choosing. As a refugee, you get to go to places that you don't choose to, in settings that you don't really know or have researched ever in your life. So this is a very different experience. And I think the film touches upon this in the sense of the loss of identity and the sense of alienation that comes from being a refugee.
Why do you think this kind of film is important to make? Why did you decide to make it? And why was it important for you to make it?
For the last few years, I've been living in various conflict zones, Afghanistan, Egypt, been traveling frequently to Syria and all of this. And I've been noticing one thing, which is that we're not able to compute people in other societies as fellow human beings. We like to think of them as fellow human beings with the same inalienable rights that we give ourselves. But when we think in terms of these human tragedies, we think in large terms, sociological, cultural, ethnic, sometimes even racial. You know, Trump for an example. So it was really important for me to try and bring this experience of what is happening in other places up close and personal, just to experience these people as fellow human beings. And I think that was the deepest motivation to make this film, and that's what I've tried to do with it.
So refugees are oftentimes portrayed in the media very negatively, and people focus more on what people think of refugees versus what the refugees themselves think. So you had this in mind when creating the film a bit. How did you try to challenge stereotypes in the media with your film?
Well, for a start, you know, refugees are always spoken for, either charitably as victims who need our help, or people who might be a problem to us, or people who might cause our society's problems, etc., etc., but always spoken for, never heard directly. So one of the things that the film actually does is to get people to represent themselves in terms of the issues that they face, in terms of who they are and what they're going through. It's not a story that comes from the angle of what we should be perceiving them as, etc. It's about what they want us to know about themselves.
With your interaction with the refugees, how was your interaction with them? Did they tell you any stories that stuck with you personally? If you could, like, speak to your experience with them a bit.
I mean, all the stories they told me are, like, in the film. But I think, having lived with them, because it was a film that, you know, apart from following them from Cairo, it was also me living undercover in these camps with them and experiencing what they were going on. So, in a way, calling them refugees still grates in my throat because I knew them in the city we all lived in together. And suddenly, by dint of being human beings with a certain passport, they were having a very different experience of what it is to live in certain social milieus. So the whole dawning of the identity of the refugee itself was really painful, and I was with them watching them go through it. And I think that, you know, that difference, the fact that I can take a plane and fly for no other reason than my passport accords me a visa, and they cannot, and they have to go through this really painful experience of camps, of having to prove themselves worthy of living amidst us. That, I think, is something that will stay with me a long time in terms of how our world works.
So you say you stayed undercover in these camps. Can you speak to that experience a bit?
Yes. At the time when all of them went into different camps across Europe, it was quite hard to get permission to go and film in these camps. I'd written to all of them, but I never got responses in time, or responses were quite evasive. So I just went in, put my cameras in a bag, and went and stayed with them at different points. Filmed them in that, going through their daily routine. The point about these camps is Rami, one of the people in my film, explained, you eat, you have a bed to sleep in, you're warm. Technically, there's nothing threatening you. But then you go to the deepest depression because you suddenly don't know who you are and you've got nothing to do. Nothing that speaks to you about what your experience as a human being is available to you to follow. And I think this is the essence of the experience in these camps. And these camps are set up not so much because the refugees need it, but because we need to satisfy ourselves that these people are worthy of living in our midst for whatever reason. Be it security, the idea that they're not terrorists, despite the fact that we know they're actually escaping terror and not creating it.
I was wondering to what extent you were accepted or rejected by the refugees just with your presence there, and how was their initial reaction to you and your project?
I mean, the group itself was hugely welcoming of what I was doing and was very, very accommodative of me because they understood what I was undertaking to do. And, of course, their generosity was hugely important in the making of this film because often we were sharing extremely cramped spaces and resources together to make the film. But sometimes there would be other people in the camps, for example, who didn't know who I was and were quite scared of what I was doing. So that was also quite interesting to see that even in, because many of them had escaped war, were afraid of being on camera, even in the West, because they thought that might have repercussions to their family at home. But these things, of course, later sorted out, and I told them that, you know, nobody who doesn't want to be in the film has to be in it, etc. Those problems got sorted, but the idea that even wanting to speak your mind might put somebody else at risk back home, that's a very powerful kind of censorship. That's also something that happens in these camps. But your question about how refugees accepted me, etc. I mean, we knew them in Egypt, and I told them about what I was doing in Egypt. They knew what I was up to, and then they were comfortable about letting me into their rooms in the camps. They did so there as well.
More technically, I guess, if you could explain a bit how you filmed the movie, what process did you have to go through, I guess what equipment you used also, and in the end, how it all came together for you.
Initially, the plan was for me to go with them on the boat with the smugglers, but at the last minute, the smugglers refused to let me on. But that is when one of the refugees, Rami, said to me, well, if you were willing to risk your life to tell our story, it's my duty to film on the boat for you. So he had a GoPro and he filmed a journey. So then we worked together in terms of the kind of shots to take, what to do daily, a digital diary, what to shoot and how long. Because on the boat, it's not the smugglers who are sailing it. It's this fellow refugees who don't have the money to pay the full board or who are forced to clean and cook and sail the boat. He filmed the journey and then we put these two things together to make the film.
Can you speak to the danger of, for example, a refugee having a GoPro on a boat? Is it dangerous if the smuggler sees them? Did the refugees themselves encounter any obstacles while trying to film their experience?
Like I just said, there are no, it's not smugglers on the boat, but there's no danger to filming on the boat because that's one of the first things we worked out, what the risks of filming are. So the people who actually own the boat are not smugglers, because if there were smugglers on the boat, they'd get arrested in Europe. The people sailing the boat are actually other refugees who do not have the money to pay the smugglers the full board. Often it's young men without the money to pay the exorbitant sums to the smugglers demand. So these young men are then told how to fuel the boat, how to cook, how to clean, etc. And that's how these boats go. So the boat is essentially sailed by people who've got no sailing experience. That's what makes the journey more dangerous. So the refugees were not in any danger filming themselves, but the danger was the boat itself.
What would you say that you'd like people to take away from the movie after having watched it?
Well, I really don't want to kind of dictate one particular interpretation of the film. But so far, what I've noticed is people leaving with a much deeper sense of empathy for what is happening to these fellow human beings who have now come to be called refugees. And I think that is the best result that I expect from the viewership of this film.
You just heard an interview with George Kurian, director of the documentary film The Crossing. That's all for this edition of Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. Make sure to tune in January to hear our next episode, and in the meantime, check out our previous coverage and podcasts at mcgilldaily.com/podcast, or pick up a print copy on stands now.
Unfit to Print.